Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm Joe Saul-Sehy from Stacking Benjamins here with my co-host. Let's start with Doug Goldstein from Goldstein on Gelt.
Hey there, everybody. How you doing?
And we have Miranda Marquette from Planting Money Seeds.
Hey, everyone. Hope you're having a great holiday season.
And of course, we can't forget the one and only Linda P. Jones from Be Wealthy and Smart.
Hello. How are you?
We are out, but guess what? That doesn't mean we're leaving you without any audio. As a podcast that has well over 120 episodes so far. Well, actually, I take that back. Almost 120 episodes.
Be optimistic.
So far. Yes. We found the three of them that we think are wonderful, and we're playing them. We're playing one of those today while we're off playing in the snow. Linda, you're playing in the snow out there in the desert, right?
I am.
Yes, absolutely. So happy holidays to everyone, and we'll see you again back here in January.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Our guest is Phil Ash. He is the CEO of Baton Investing. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Miranda.
This episode is going to look at some of the investing mistakes that people are likely to make. And Phil has some interesting investing mistakes that maybe you might not have thought about in the past. So let's go ahead and just dive right in. Why don't you start out? What are some of these investing mistakes that people often make?
Conventional wisdom, which I have and pretty much all of us have fallen prey to over the years with regards to many things, but I'll start with the 401k, for example. 401ks are notorious for giving you basically a fairly pathetic selection of mutual funds, depending on your employer and the plan that they've chosen. Maybe they've chosen ones with low fees, or maybe there's, you know, even some higher hidden fees in there that you're not aware of. But what I challenge people to do, and what I did 2 years ago when I my brother and I first set out to launch our business Baton, is actually take a look at what your long-term track record has been in your 401k, your historical annual average. And for me, it was horrific. It was something like 3%. What I was doing, and what I gather most people are doing from the conversations I've had with many people, is basically taking this conventional, well-diversified approach. I'm going to have a little bit in large caps, some small caps, some mid caps, some international, a little bit of bond, maybe some gold. And you know, some people actually are educated when they go through this process and take a fairly reasonable shot at it. And others really have no clue what they're doing, right? So you basically, and as you know, most DIY investors, even most professionals, rarely beat the S&P 500. In most cases, people in the S&P 500 historical average, as I'm sure you know, is 9%. Most people are going to dramatically underperform that. As I said, I was in about the 3-4% range. That kind of begs the question, you know, let's just say it's 4% that you're getting, or I'll be generous and I'll say 7%. If you tax effect that, let's just say a 30% effective tax rate, you know, federal and state combined, that's roughly a 10% after-tax return that you're getting. And never mind the fact that you're going to have to actually, you know, pay taxes when you withdraw from your 401k. It's just tax deferral. Whereas if you could find a process that would deliver 15, 16% or higher, which, you know, we'll get to that later in the show, I'm sure, but that, you know, that's obviously hard to find. You could be returning and get an after-tax return of north of 11%. So every situation is going to be different, but I just challenge people to look at the return that they're getting and consider, do I really want to lock my money up in a 401k? Because, you know, you can take out a loan for a primary residence and a few other things, but your money's really locked up until retirement. You don't have a lot of control over it. And you're having to choose from generally a pretty weak set of mutual funds. Would you be better off just putting your money into an IRA and getting a better return elsewhere?
Okay, that's a good point. We like to assume that, oh, well, once we're investing in this 401k, we're done, we're covered, and we move on. And really, we may not be. So what is another mistake people often make with their investing?
Yeah, sure. And just jumping back to the 401k real quickly, I personally, at my company, I don't get a match. And I think it's something like 60% of employees do not get a match. If you get a match from your employer, that changes the dynamic and the 401k becomes, you know, really a very good option. So just wrapping that one up. What else do mistakes do people make? Let's see. Well, this isn't quite an investing thing, but it's something to consider. And I know several people who do this. And this is paying off your mortgage early, especially considering the last 5 to 10 years, the environment that we've been in with people having 3-4% mortgage rates. And, you know, if you take a 4% mortgage rate and tax effect that, you know, for the write off you're getting, that's really like a 3% mortgage rate. So to take your free cash and put it towards paying off that debt is essentially admitting that you don't think you can get better than a 3% after tax return elsewhere. And, you know, as I said before, I mean, you can just drop it in SPY, the S&P 500 ETF, and get a historical average of 9%. So that one, it doesn't really make sense for me. The one argument I hear, which makes sense, and this depends on your risk profile, is some people simply don't like to be indebted and they like that conservative feeling that they own their house. So I get that. But when you look at the numbers, it doesn't add up.
Right. Yeah. And we have this sort of allergy to any sort of debt at all without stopping to think about, well, what is this debt really doing? I mean, there's a difference between mortgage debt that is tax deductible and that is very low interest and consumer debt like a credit card that's very high interest and comes with no tax benefit at all.
Yeah, I mean, really, when you're sitting on free cash, you really just need to make a list of all your options that you could do with that cash. And so you're comparing apples to apples, try and put all of those options on an after-tax basis and simply put your money, move your money in the direction of the highest interest rate you can find, whether that's reducing debt at a high interest rate or investing in an investment at a high interest rate.
Right. And that's a very good point. So what else? I mean, what's another mistake that people are prone to make when they're investing or trying to figure out what to do with their assets?
So I'm going to start with the macro, the very kind of starting point that an investor should have, a new investor. And frankly, this is a starting point that more than half of us should retreat to or revisit because we haven't taken this first step already. And that's simply figuring out what your goal is. If you don't set a goal, you're not going to hit it, right?
Right.
And that, again, when my brother and I launched our business, it started with a realization for me that I simply was underperforming the S&P despite all the effort I was putting into it. So the first step was figuring out like what my actual returns were over a long-term period. And I don't just mean the recent, you know, 5-year bull market because everybody's all giddy waving their arms in the air. Right. I'm getting, you know, 15% annual returns. Well, yeah, I mean, the rising tide raises all boats, right? But, you know, you really got to look over a longer period of time, assuming you've been investing pre-2008 and determine, you know, what is my real long-term average annual return? So that's the first step is figuring out what has been your track record. And then secondly, figure out what your goal is. We'll just use retirement goal as an example. You could have, you know, saving for a house or car or vacation, whatever. But there's all kinds of online calculators out there that you can use, retirement calculators. I find most of them kind of laughable because I shouldn't say most, many, because they don't even let you pick an interest rate of return higher than 10%. That's kind of like this, you know, typical kind of Wall Street conventional wisdom that you couldn't possibly beat the S&P 500 average of 9%. So they cap their calculators at 10%. Go pick out any one of these calculators. We have one on our website, batoninvesting.com. And plug your numbers in, you know, what your current age is, what your desired retirement age is, how much money you have now, how much money you think you can put away each year, and your hoped for annual rate of return or some calculators just dictated to you. I think, at least in the discussions I've had with friends and the awakening process I went through, I think you're going to be pretty shocked when you see what that number really is.
Well, I think you make a good point, though. The Employee Benefits Research Institute says that more than half of workers haven't even sat down and thought about what their retirement needs are going to be. And I think that goes into your point of a lot of people haven't really thought about their goal. They're like, oh, well, I'm just saving money. But it's harder to make those investing decisions, figure out your risk profile, figure out how much you really should be setting aside, and figure all of that out if you haven't even sat down and said, well, really, what are my goals? What do I hope to accomplish? What do I want this money to do for me? So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I really like that idea of just sitting down and figuring that out. So so we've kind of gone through, I guess, three big mistakes. What are some of the other mistakes? I mean, you mentioned that there are five main mistakes. So we're more than halfway through.
Yeah, I could probably come up with 20. But,
right.
So another one, which is and. If you thought I was bucking the trend with the 401k advice, you'll find I'm really in the minority here. Is thinking that diversification equals safety, and you know there's various quotes out there from the gurus. You know, Warren Buffett, I believe, said something like, diversification is really for people who don't know what they're doing. You know, and 10 to maybe 25, 30 stocks is really the optimal portfolio size if beating the market is your objective. But most people have been fed this conventional wisdom that you want to be diversified. Once you own one mutual fund, which I guarantee everybody listening to this podcast does, I mean, if you're in a 401k or pretty much any sort of plan, you probably own at least one mutual fund. Once you do that, you own 500 stocks right there, probably at a minimum, right?
Right. Yeah, especially if you're doing something like you said, doing the S&P or doing some sort of an all market fund.
Yeah. And then you layer on a few more mutual funds and ETFs and, you know, now you've got thousands of stocks. So you pretty much mirror the market. You've become the market minus the fees. So the historical average of the S&P is 9%. You know, now maybe you're losing 1%, even as much as 5%. If you're doing front end load funds or what have you, you know, that advisors are more prone to put you into. That's how you're killing your performance by being over diversified. Now, back to the safety issue, you know, our biggest threat to safety as investors, not the regular, common, expected gyrations of the market. The market, I guarantee you, will crash again.
Right.
Everybody knows that, right? But the biggest threat is our emotions. And I'm sure you've probably had some speakers on your podcast who can dive a lot deeper into this than I can. And I was an emotional investor before launching Baton Investing. I would buy high and sell low. And I would get out at the wrong times. Why? Because I did not subscribe to a simple bucket strategy, which I assume most people are familiar with, but real quickly is, and some people espouse a two bucket strategy or a three bucket strategy. Generally, you know, you basically want your safety bucket, your emergency money that either you're actually going to need to tap into if, your second bucket, your growth bucket goes to hell in a handbasket. But the real value in that safety bucket, I believe, assuming that you are employable and, you're not at risk of getting laid off, is simply to keep your emotions in check so that when your growth bucket, the majority of your assets, perhaps besides your primary residence, if you own a home, when that does tank 30%, 40 more, whatever it is, you don't panic and sell.
Right.
And I think that the real key to safety is having that two bucket system that allows you to take an aggressive, proven growth strategy in your growth bucket and really make your money work as hard as it possibly can. Whereas if your growth bucket is this diversified set of funds, international, large cap, small cap, et cetera, I think you're just, yes, you're giving yourself more safety there by having hedges, gold and bonds and whatever against those dips. But if you have your safety bucket that keeps you from selling that growth bucket prematurely, why not just swing for the fences in that growth bucket?
That's an interesting take. You don't often hear it making that kind of risky. And we have talked about buckets in the past on our podcast. And so you might want to go back and listen to that episode on that we talked about on buckets and filling those up. So what is your final tip right now? Your final mistake, I should say, that people often make, that investors often make?
Is imposing an age limit on yourself. Target date funds do this, of course, you know, as you near retirement, as you near, you know, if it's a 529 plan, as your child nears college, what have you, we shift our allocation into safer investments. And, you know, if you're retiring at 65, I mean, my grandmother's still kicking at 94. So, you know, I hope I got those genes, but I am expecting that I am going to be retired for 30 years.
At least, yeah.
If you get to 65 years old and all of a sudden you kind of draw in and shift to this kind of fixed income kind of strategy, then you could, you know, run out of money, right?
Right.
Now,
yeah.
if you've done the numbers and you've assembled enough of a nest egg and determined that you can live on 3-4% and your capital will get you to the finish line, great. Yeah. So I think people go cautious early. And again, that bucket strategy is what you can use to provide that safety net instead.
Yeah, we tend to get caught up in these rules of thumb that say, oh, well, we have to do 100 minus your age or 120 minus your age, but we fail to look at, well, what's your actual lifestyle? What are you actually going to do? What are the realities of your situation? We often forget about the fact that rules of thumb are just that, generalizations. And so we can't always rely on that sort of conventional wisdom to help us in the long run.
So I'll give you if you want like a sixth bonus mistake, I'll give you that one as well.
Yeah, go ahead. One more.
This will be a hybrid, really. And this is essentially who and how you decide to manage your money.
Okay.
So on one end, you've got financial advisors. And on the other end, you've got DIY. In the middle, you've got, robo advisors and various other advisory services out there, such as ours. The advisor that's going to be the right fit for some people who really are terrified of investing, don't want to put in the effort, learn about it and so forth, and don't mind paying the 1% or 2% in fees. But, you know, it's kind of a slam dunk just to point out that 1-2% of fees just kills you over the long haul.
Right, right.
And most advisors do not beat the S&P 500. So, again, I would say, you know, you can assemble your safety bucket of cash and your long-term bucket and put it all in SPY and save yourself that 1-2% of fees, and you're going to do better than ever hiring an advisor. And then on the other end of the spectrum, it's, you know, just a minute percentage of DIY investors who actually beat the market. You know, I think DIY investors they'll seek out advice in many cases, and they'll find a strategist, a theory that they like and works for them. But again, the human emotions are just the killer in those instances. You know, as soon as there's a market downturn, you lose faith in a particular strategy and you jump to the next one. And it's this, you know, kind of endless cycle.
Thank you for joining us today. And if you could real quickly, once again, just remind our listeners of where they can find you, what you do, and where they can find you online.
Yeah, absolutely. So my brother and I founded batoninvesting.com in September of 2014. Basically, this is a stock picking system that has delivered 500% returns since 2003, while the S&P 500 has delivered only 170% in that time. That's a 16% average annual return versus 9%. What we did is I did a bunch of online research and basically found an MIT engineer who had launched an algorithm for himself and for his money management clients. And he basically went and read the books by all the great gurus, Warren Buffett, Peter Lynch, and so forth, and build an artificial intelligence algorithm around how they select stocks. That is his secret sauce. And it was a bit complicated, so we put it in an app. It now literally takes you, you get a push notification on your phone once a month, 30 seconds, 3 clicks and a login, and you're done with your investing for the month.
Huh.
It's been a lifesaver for me, and I think it can help a lot of people.
Welcome to this week's roundtable discussion, where we will talk about our interview with Phil Ashe and even talk maybe about some of our own investing mistakes and what we think the biggest investing mistakes are. Because you really don't want to go into this making huge blunders, because it could mean the end of your finances as you know them. So let's go ahead and start out just kind of with what you think the biggest investing mistake might be. And let's start with you, Andrea. What do you think is the biggest investing mistake that someone can make?
I actually think the biggest investing mistake is not paying attention to fees. I think fees, honestly, is the number one thing that can kill you between, you know, if you're in a mutual fund, load fees, management fees, trade fees. Those can quickly eat into all of your returns, no matter how great your returns are. You know, if you are getting 12%, but you're paying 3% to get that, you're no further ahead.
That's a good point. And that's something that Phil kind of alluded to in our interview as well, that you do need to watch out for those fees and be aware of what you're paying. So what about you, Andrew? What do you think is the biggest mistake that people make when investing?
So I guess my biggest mistake was just not being aware. And I think for myself, I was fortunate because I didn't really pursue investing and money. I had somebody who I worked with who mentored me through the process and got me really excited about money. And then from there, I was able to pretty much have a really smart and prudent investment strategy from the beginning. So right at the beginning of my career, I had somebody to look up to and to give me guidance. And from there, I just took off and found the best strategies that have worked. So in the past, you know, I maybe didn't realize how adverse debt can be. And I didn't see, I feel like there's a moment where you just figure everything out and you realize that this whole money thing is really adding and subtracting. It's a black and white thing. Either you're helping your net worth or you're hurting the net worth. And so obviously debt has a lot to do with that. And so I think many of the people who listen to this already are pursuing the investing and this money information. I think they're already on top. I think the people who maybe are making a lot of the mistakes we were talking about on this podcast probably aren't listening to this podcast. And so a lot of it can be avoided if you just have that desire.
Okay. It is worth noting too that I think we did do an earlier episode of this podcast about looking for investing resources and looking for mentors. So that's something you can go back to. If you, like Andrew, want to find a mentor or want to look into resources, we'll include that in the show notes so that you can go back and listen to that episode about these resources.
Seriously, I mean, the best thing you can do as an investor is get educated. And I think that starts with going through all the archives. We've had listeners talk about how they've downloaded every single archive, and each episode has given a specific topic and lesson. And so I think doing that will really help you out.
Right. Okay. And what about you, Joe? What do you think is...
Well, I'm with Andrew. Some of the biggest mistakes are ones that I also agree. I think people that listen to this podcast wouldn't make, but that's constantly looking at short-term, what's in front of your nose that you need for your money today, and not looking enough at long-term strategies. I think people don't get compounding interest just in general. I think people that listen to this show do, but I think that people just in general don't think about, if I set more money aside, that money then works for me. That's less work that I have to do myself. I can get all these short-term things today, or I can have my money get me a lot of stuff down the road. The type of things that people that listen to this show, I think the biggest type of mistakes our audience probably makes, things like having the right investment but the wrong tax strategy, like forgetting to look at whether we have it in a Roth IRA or whether we have it in a pre-tax IRA or... You know, because I've seen the tax bite, like Andrea talks about fees, which is a big bite. Taxes are also a huge bite. So having your investments in the right spot, I think, is the type of mistake somebody listening to this podcast would make.
That's a good point. We sometimes forget about the tax implications, and that can make a big difference down the road. And I just kind of want to put in my own big investing mistake that I think, as you probably mentioned before, some of these mistakes are not things that someone listening to this podcast would make. But I think one of the biggest mistakes that the general population makes is not getting started in investing in general.
Yeah.
Because so many people are like, I don't have enough money. They have all these excuses. I don't have enough money. I don't understand it well enough. All of these excuses, when thanks to technology and thanks to information, it's very easy to get started. If you have pocket change these days, you can get started investing. And as one reviewer pointed out, I am boring, all about the indexing, but they said it like it was a good thing. So hooray. And you can get started. You do want to go out there. You do want to be aware. You do want to know what's going on, but anybody can get started investing with $25 and an automatic investment plan into an index fund. And just get started there and then start, once you're doing that automatically and you're kind of at least getting started with growing your wealth, then you can get out there and learn about other strategies and about other ways to maybe do more with your money.
On that note, Miranda, about people not getting started, there was a study recently that was on the NAPA.net website, which is the National Association of Plan Advisors, the people that manage 401ks and retirement plans. Mm-hmm. And it was a millennial study that showed that said that millennials, when they were polled, said they want to save more, but they don't feel like they have enough money to save. And the sad thing, I think, that a lot of millennials maybe need to learn is that you're always going to feel like that. You're right. Never going to feel like you have money to save. So I found that study to be kind of sad that, I just don't feel like I can.
Right.
And go ahead, Miranda.
I was just going to say the reality is it's more important to start developing that habit. So even if you're like, oh, well, I can only save like $50 a month, that's better than saving $0 a month. Let's be real.
I think small steps, like Joe said, the power of compounding interest, once you can understand that, it doesn't matter how small you start. Once you get that thing rolling, it's going to compound over time. And the earlier you start, the longer it can roll and really make a big impact. And we have listeners who are listening to this, but they might have people they know who won't ever get this money strategy. I mean, I had a mentor who reached out to me, and he was the one who kind of took the initiative for me, and I feel so grateful for that. And so why can't us, take on that responsibility and help other people as well? Give them an episode that you like, share with them these small ideas, and from there, you could really help somebody out and they could maybe become the next Warren Buffett, just because we talk about millennials who don't want to get started. Maybe we can help some of these millennials. Sometimes that initiative needs to be taken by somebody else for somebody to really get interested in the topic.
And I think too, though, just developing the habit can be something that benefits you down the road. And saving and investing tends to be, in my mind, kind of addictive. And it's kind of like, once you see like, oh wait, I really do have a little bit of extra money that I can do this with. Once you see that, you start looking for ways. Oh, well, how can I boost that? How can I set more aside? How can I increase the amount I'm setting aside? It starts to become kind of a game because you want to take that next step. And so I think that's an important thing to remember too, is once you take that first step, subsequent steps do become easier.
Yeah, I totally agree. Take that first step. Take a smart step.
That's right.
Nice.
Put an Andrea aside. Take a smart step. And get going. All right. So let's dive in a little bit. Ash mentioned a lot about 401k companies and what to do, and how some of them are terrible. And what can you do? I mean, what are some of the things that you can do if your company's 401k is just awful? And let's start with you, Joe, because you've probably seen this in your past as a financial planner, as a financial industry insider. So what can people do if their company's 401k is just awful?
Well, let me start off with just a little bit of a rant, which is that I hear people talk about these horrible 401ks all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And even though I agree with Andrea that you have to pay attention to fees in your plan, and we've also seen some lawsuits recently against companies that have egregious fees, I haven't seen that many just horrible, horrible 401ks. I think it's fun for people to talk about how bad these 401ks are. And I would have clients come in, or potential clients come in for a first meeting, and they'd show me their 401k. They go, yeah, this thing really stinks. I'm like, okay, you only have 8 options, but they're all Vanguard. I mean, they're all low cost, proven performers. So I think it's in vogue to bash 401ks. But I do agree with what Phil said when it comes to, if you do have a really bad 401k, you might need to look elsewhere. But realize this: if you're eligible for a 401k every single day of the year, you may not, depending on your income level, you may not be eligible to put money pre-tax someplace else. So you have to really, and I mean, it's got to be a really bad 401k to give up a, let's say that you're in the 25% tax bracket and you've got a 5% state tax, you're avoiding you're getting a 30%, not rate of return, but you're avoiding a 30% tax by putting that money in the 401k today and letting it grow. So those fees got to be really, really bad to do it. But you know, you can put money in a Roth IRA, assuming that you're eligible, or if you live outside the United States, some of the, you know, the plans like a Roth IRA. I can't remember what's the one in Canada called.
The TFSA. It's like my most favorite thing ever.
Yes. Yep. So you can use a plan like that. You can look for investments that are low cost and still defer taxes. But I think you got to do a lot of math before you avoid your 401k.
That's a good point. And I think that kind of touches on something else that Phil talked about, was investment diversity. You mentioned something, Joe, about how, you know, some of these plans only have like 8 things to choose from. But really, do you need a lot more? And let's talk about that a little bit, Andrea. How much diversity do you really need? Is there such a thing as over-diversification?
I don't know if there's really a thing as over-diversification. I actually think, as much as, you know, do you need to own 500 individual stocks? I don't think it's necessary, but do you own an index mutual fund? I think it's totally fine. I don't think you can over diversify. I actually think the opposite problem is most people under diversify. So I'm kind of against that one. I'm like, you know, if I own 500 stocks, I own 500, but it's more the other. I just read a report somewhere. I think it was SigFi Investing, that an overwhelming majority of Americans had more than 23% of their assets in a single stock.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So I don't think over-diversification is an issue at all.
So, yeah, but do you think, do you think that if you've got like an index fund and you've got these 8 choices, do you think that's going to be, you said that that was going to be sufficient. So there's this kind of weird balance.
Now, obviously, you have to kind of put an asterisk next to that, that it depends on what those 8 options are. But, you know, if we're talking about Vanguard index funds and you're choosing, you know, the small index, the large, you know, I don't think that's a problem at all.
Okay, that's
as long as you're covering all segments. You know, if you have 500 stocks and they're all large cap, okay, that might be a problem. But, you know, if you've got 500 to 1,000 stocks and it's across the entire market in a mutual fund, I don't see that as a problem.
Okay. And what about you, Andrew, kind of coming from a standpoint of a value investor and somebody who does do individual stocks, what do you think about this idea of over-diversification? And is it something that you do need to watch out for?
I think you certainly do need to watch out for it, but when it comes to a mutual fund, something to realize is that if you can't just buy one and think you're diversified, that single mutual fund has an additional risk. I mean, it's not the same as owning 500 companies. When people pile money out of the mutual fund, it's going to go down in price regardless of what the holdings are doing. And so if you're only holding one mutual fund thinking you're properly diversified, I don't think, you know, I just don't see there's a disconnect there. So you need to understand, to Andrea's point, there's different rates of return for different segments, and different parts of the market are going to react differently depending on what time of the year it is. I mean, sometimes large caps do really well. Sometimes it's small cap. Sometimes international. Sometimes growth or value. So for me, myself, when I'm picking stocks, it comes from a value perspective, but I always pick stocks that also are growing year over year, have really great 1 year and 3 year growth rates. You want to try to hit as many of those things as you can, and that's how you'll be diversified. You can't just pile into one sector or one market cap type and think you're diversified, because you're not.
And finally, I did kind of want to touch a little bit on this idea of paying down debt and whether or not it's a viable investment, and what makes sense in terms of paying down debt. So let's go ahead and go back to you, Joe. What do you think of paying down debt? Do you think this is one of the best investments you can make, or does it sort of depend?
It does depend. It depends on the interest rate of the debt. Because if you look at the debt, if I've got a mortgage that's at 4% and I'm looking at my long-term goals and they're not funded, like Phil said, it's a 4% rate of return is easy to beat historically over long periods of time. You're not going to get that every day, but certainly if you've got 10, 15, 20 years, you can beat 4% with just a little knowledge. So I wouldn't pay extra on that debt. That's not a good investment of your money. But if you've got a credit card that's at 23%, you know, then it's like earning a 23% rate of return on your money. So putting money toward the credit card and then changing that habit so you no longer use the 23% credit card anymore is, I think, a good 1-2 punch.
I think you make a good point, too, about changing that habit. Too often, the reality of the situation is your debt is not the problem. Your debt right. is a symptom of your problem.
Right. It's like the leaf on the tree. Yeah. It's a leaf on the tree.
Right. So what do you think, Andrea? What do you think about debt in terms of how it relates to investing?
Well, I'm kind of with Joe. It really depends on the situation. I do think if you look at it from a purely mathematical standpoint, talking about the low interest debt, not the credit card debt, but like the home mortgage debt, it mathematically, it makes sense to keep the mortgage. I always second that with, you know, you do have to look at some level of where your risk tolerance is. Do you want a mortgage or not? And how that fits into everything. And then I am a big believer that your ultimate goal should be to hit retirement with no debt. Because when you're not working or you're not in the job market and have the ability to go create extra income and you're living off your investments, I think that makes your debt your biggest risk factor. So, you know, don't maybe necessarily aggressively pay it off because you can go beat the 3% rate or whatever. But at the same time, keep in mind that you do want it paid off by the time you hit retirement.
Right. You don't want to be like refinancing ad nauseum just to keep doing other things.
Yeah. But it's starting to be a really big trend that a lot of retirees are retiring with a lot of debt. You know, it used to be that nobody retired with debt. Now it's kind of going the opposite direction. And I think that's dangerous.
Which is why a lot of retirees have part-time jobs. I mean, that's why a lot of high school and college students report they can't get summer jobs because grandma still has the job.
To pay her mortgage.
That's right. Yeah. No, it's a serious problem.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true. I mean, we laugh about it, but you're right. I mean, if you're stuck on this fixed income, what happens when the stock market does terribly and now you can't pay your mortgage or you have to dip more into your capital, your original principal than you wanted to? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a problem. All right. And finally, what are your thoughts on that, Andrew?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with everything you guys said. I think that's exactly on point. If you ask Mark Cuban if he were to start over, take away all his money, what would be the one thing that he would do? What's the first thing he would do? And he would say he'd get out of debt. So I agree, and I'm very anti-debt. At the same time, I think paying off debt early really depends on what Joe alluded to, the interest rate, what your risk tolerance is. It's going to be personal for everybody. For somebody in my age bracket, you really have to think about what kind of a mortgage are you going to take out? If, you know, I know a lot of my peers want to take out a mortgage, want to pursue the American dream, but you really have to consider how much is that mortgage that you're taking out. Depending on what part of the country you live, the loan amount and that principal can be really different. Understand that, and understand that taking a loan that's twice, even though if the interest rate's at 3%, but your principal is twice the national average, I mean, you're just not going to get wealthy. The numbers just won't add up. So before you make a big life decision that could basically determine your financial future, try to check the principal and see what your other options are.
Can we get just a little technical for a second?
Oh, because, go for it.
Well, because this is about Phil's point, talking about about interest rates. I think with long-term debt, I love what Andrea's saying about paying off your mortgage early. And if you can trust yourself not to touch the money, which there's a huge segment of the population that can't trust themselves, so know yourself before you do this. Rather than paying extra on the mortgage, I like taking those extra mortgage payments and putting them in an S&P 500 fund and have it be my pay off the mortgage early fund. And we would do this with clients when I was an advisor. And what's cool is over the 16 years of my practice, by the time I sold my business, I had some clients that had accumulated enough money in that pay off the mortgage early fund to actually pay off the mortgage. And what was cool was that when they got there, you know how many people actually used that money to pay off the mortgage in one fell swoop?
None.
Nobody. But what was neat was they had the ability to do it whenever the heck they wanted to. And that was huge power for them. That money still sat there and it still grew. And they knew that that money was going to be used to pay down the mortgage. And some people, when they retired, I had a couple people that reached retirement age and had this fund on the side. They would then use that to make the mortgage payment so that it would continue growing more quickly than the mortgage did over a longer period of time. So for people that won't touch that money and use it for other stuff, I like that for a pay down your mortgage quick strategy.
I like that too. And I like how, it also sort of allows them to retire maybe early without actually paying off their entire mortgage and having the entire mortgage totally paid off.
Yeah.
Because they can use it for their payments and part of the money is still going to be earning a better return.
Right. Because to Andrea's point, you know, I mean, they had debt literally, but now they can do other things and not worry about where that mortgage payment comes from.
Well, and I think a very key thing to keep in mind with all debt, not just low interest rate debt, but all of it, is when you're calculating your retirement target, you know, you're looking at what are my expenses. Well, debt increases your expenses. Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of depending on how you want to look at it. If you pay it down, you have to save less for retirement because your expenses are lower. So it is one of those things I don't think people think about, but if there's no debt, you don't need as much money.
I did read something this last week that there's a new trend that people, once they get their mortgage paid off, they cancel their homeowner's insurance because they don't. Because isn't that horrible? It's absolutely horrible, but they go, hey, the bank doesn't require it anymore, so I'm going to get rid of it. Worst thing
unless
you could ever.
Unless you've got multiple millions sitting on the side.
Oh my gosh, what happens when you, like, your home is destroyed and you have to pay to have it rebuilt? Oh my gosh.
I'm like, you did something so smart by paying off this mortgage and then you followed it up with the dumbest move ever.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I'm shocked. Okay. I can't believe that's like a real thing. All right. Well, I think that should wrap it up for this week. We're out of time. But remember that you can visit each of our websites for more information about investing. You can also leave us a review. Let us know what we're doing right or wrong. Apparently, some of our voices are annoying, but there's nothing we can do about that. I'm sorry.
We could all go take voice lessons together.
This is the way God made us. Go ahead, leave us a review. Let us know if you have any questions. If you've got a subject you would like us to tackle, we enjoy reader questions and we enjoy reading the reviews. So keep them coming. And remember that nobody else is going to take care of your money as well as you do. So learn how to invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.